From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. I'm filling in today for Terry Gross. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet magician Penn Jillette. He's one half of Penn and Teller, the duo that's to regular magicians what the Rolling Stones are to the Berlin Philharmonic. Also today, we meet master crime writer Elmore Leonard. He tells us how he learned to blow up a car, do a mafia hit, and a few other tricks of the trade. New Orleans pianist Harry Connick Jr. joins us once more in our weekly performance spot, and critic Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of Tougher Than Leather. It's an urban gangster movie starring the rap group Run DMC. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. If you think magic is some guy in a tux pulling doves out of his sleeves, then you've never seen Penn and Teller. In their words, they're just two eccentric guys who have learned to do a few cool things. A typical thing is when Penn hangs Teller upside down in a straitjacket over a bed of spikes while Penn reads Casey at the Bat very fast. Now, that wouldn't be so nerve-wracking if there wasn't a rope attached from the back of Penn's chair to Teller's ankles. And if Penn hadn't warned you beforehand that when he was done, he was going to spring to his feet for a bow, thereby releasing the rope and his partner. In another bit, Teller picks a card out of a deck by plunging a knife into it and seemingly right through Penn's hand. The pair's PBS special Penn and Teller Go Public won them two Emmys. They're finishing up a feature-length movie. It's called Penn and Teller Get Killed. And they have a home video and a book, both entitled Penn and Teller's Cruel Tricks for Dear Friends. On stage, Penn Jillette does all the talking, and that goes for radio interviews as well. The pair met back when Penn was in high school. I asked him if he was the class clown in those days.
I was the sullen intellectual creep.
Oh, no.
Who wanted to grow up and be Camus. That's true.
Is that true?
And I had hair down way down my back and very, very wild, and wore eye makeup and said obscenities to every teacher. But it never was in a comedic way. It was just a pure hostility.
Pure hostility.
And I didn't like school much. And I met Teller, actually. Teller was teaching high school the whole time I was in it. Teller's 7 years older than I am. So he was teaching at a different high school. And we were talking, like you talk when you meet somebody that you really get along with, about how we just hated magic and just hated theater and just hated comedy. You know, comedy at that time was as bad as it is now. It was just jokes that kind of reinforce the status quo. Let's make fun of any minority group we can think of and make a buck. And theater was just bad. And magic, of course, no one has to trash because everybody knows what's wrong with that. And there's a thing put out in San Francisco by the Residents, who are an avant-garde band, called the Roztalk Manifesto, that had the line in it, "If you hate supermarket music, for Christ's sake, start making supermarket music." And I said to Teller, we hate this stuff so much. And there was so much stuff. I mean, magic is a great idea for theater. The strongest thing you can have in theater is irony. That's what everybody's going for, from Oedipus Rex right up through. You're always trying to get a hold of that. And magic has that built in. And then Doug Henning had come along, and he had said to people, think of this as a child. Don't try to think that it's a trick. Think of it as an illusion. And he didn't mean think of it as a child. He meant be stupid, because children are very inquisitive. He was saying to people, be stupid and take this at face value. Now, if we're taking it at face value, why aren't we watching a movie where they can do it better? So what the whole angle we took was trying to play up that irony and get people to have a chip on their shoulder and know that it's fake.
Well, you say, really, that the message of magic is that I know something you don't know, and that makes me a better person. But what I think is interesting, what you've done, is to say, I know something you don't know. I'm going to show you how to do it, and I'm going to trick you anyway.
Yeah, well, there's the idea that magicians have used for years of I can do this and you can't is so ludicrous when you have a theater full of people that can program computers and perform surgery and fix cars and all these other things that are completely mystical to me.
Yeah.
So we didn't want to do that, you know, because you can vanish a quarter. I'm a jerk, you know what I mean? there is an important thing. I mean, if I had to sum up one of the themes of our show, it's if two guys, just regular guys, with a limited budget and a little bit of work, can pull off these things that are obviously lies and look real, what the hell can other people do, like the government or Coca-Cola? I mean, what can those guys pull off? I mean, one of the more more obvious themes of the show is that. And magic is, I mean, to be able to see something that you know is not real is a neat thing. It's a fun thing.
Have you always hated magic and magicians?
No. I used to say that every 12-year-old boy read a biography of Houdini and then read one magic book. And then women would say, you're out of your mind. Every person does that. Same time about you read the autobiography of Helen Keller, you read the Houdini thing. About the same time. And you just think he's the coolest guy in the world. You just say, you know, and you just fall in love with it. And you get like one magic book and you tell your mom and dad about it. And then your parents start understanding that you like magic.
So the birthday presents.
They call you down, you know, when it's on TV. And we'd come down, you know, I'd run downstairs and there'd be like this, you know, this very non-hip looking guy in a bad costume pushing a woman around who was clearly doing all the work, but we never knew her name, and playing like bad rip-off music that wasn't even on guitars. And you just go, no. So at about the age of 13, you know, one of those shows after The Magician was The Who, you know? And I said, oh, yeah, no, these guys, they got haircuts, they, you know, they look all right, they're smashing their instruments. This is entertainment. You know, this is not, you know, shoving women into boxes and turning them into animals.
Well, so you didn't do the kind of birthday party?
No, I never did that at all. My parents had infinite patience, so the 6 months or year that I went through magic, they actually would watch the little card tricks. But mostly what that did was it stayed in the back of my head is how could Houdini be a superstar of his day doing this form? I mean, he wasn't best for a magician. He was Springsteen at that time. Yeah. He was Madonna at that time. And now we had people that they were saying, well, of course we don't like him, but he's good for a magician. It was like this Special Olympics of showbiz. And we just wondered why, you know, why. And one of the reasons is that it became really popular to do stuff to women, have them do all the work, and then just hold your arms out.
You mean like cutting them in half?
Yeah, and pulling their middles out and all that kind of stuff, which I'm not bothered at all by the kind of violence of that. I mean, I don't think that anybody goes and says, this is something you should do to women. I don't think that's where the insult lies. The insult lies in someone else doing the actual performance and a different person taking credit for it. That's the more insidious danger of that.
Well,
and so all the stuff we do to ourselves or someone from the audience.
Well, you usually do to Teller, wouldn't you say?
Well,
I mean,
you know,
to be honest here.
I'm the one that puts the fire in my mouth.
That's true.
I'm the one that gets handcuffed against my will.
Okay.
And I'm the one that gets the knife through my hand.
Okay, so it's
so
it's
Teller,
even.
Teller does the stuff that's dangerous that he lives through.
Yeah.
I do the stuff that is permanent damage. Matter of fact, my resume says permanent damage, okay.
Well, I guess we can tell who's older, right, and who gets the easier parts. Well, you went to clown school, isn't that right?
Ooh,
at Ringling Brothers Barnum, or clown college, I guess.
Yes.
Is this a painful memory for you?
Well, I went when I was very young. I was the youngest person there. I was 18.
This was after high school?
Yeah, and I didn't want to, I just didn't feel good about college. It seemed to me at that time that all college was, you're going to hear this obsession come up again, was people like smoking dope. And I just thought there must be some place, you know, that I can read the stuff I want to read and listen to music incredibly loud and not be surrounded by drugs. There's going to be something better.
Just a sidetrack, your anti-drug, anti-alcohol stance, you've always felt that way? I mean, was it a bad experience you knew?
I've never had a sip in my life anything and never had any drug at all. And, I drink, this is a Diet Cola beverage I'm drinking here. But
you've never wanted to?
No, I mean, if you want to actually press, I've broken bones and been given things in the hospital that knocked me out. But never recreationally. And I don't know. My parents are complete teetotalers. And I think that's, as I get older, every single answer that I've given before as to why seems to be much less important with the fact that when I grew up, I didn't even know that people did that. And by the time I hit 18 and I would meet people and they would say, you know, I heard you never had a drug in your life, you know, it became like a character trait. And then the more druggy of my friends would even start to protect me even more. No, he doesn't do that kind of stuff. And still, I'll tell you, you meet rock and roll stars. Like, I've been able to meet some of my heroes, and I'm able to say that to them. And they just, it's like I'm saying I can fly under my own power, you know, because these guys are all on the other side of it.
That's
and they all live exactly like I live. There's no difference. But there's that whole chunk of 10 years when we were doing very different things. Like, I can remember things that happened in 77. I may be the only one, but I know certain things that happened in 70. I know like what albums came out. I know what I was doing, where I was living. And there's virtually no one else can tell that. I mean, when they go back into history, that period of time from like 72 to 80, you're going to have to take my word for it.
So you are a living historian
yes,
I am.
That's all I live for.
Well, let me get back to the clown college.
Oh, I tried to. I thought I really cleverly
tried to sneak around that, but I'm interested just because I mean you found that a place to go where you could find people.
Well, it was at the time a very difficult place to get into. I knew it would be very different. College, it all of a sudden dawned on me that there was some sort of scam going on, because when I was in junior high, they said to me, you know, Penn, I know you're not learning anything, but we're just preparing you to learn stuff in high school. And then I got to my first year of high school, and they said, well, you're not really learning anything now, but, you know, your senior year, you're going to. And I started to, I was brought up in Greenfield, Massachusetts, which is like 20 miles from the five college area, Amherst and UMass and everything. And I started to go and sit in on classes, which were essentially saying, well, you're not learning very much now. When you pick your major, you will be. And it started to dawn on me that maybe you were going to hear when you get your master's, you're going to learn something, and then it was going to be doctorate, and maybe you were never going to get out of this scam.
Maybe, when you die.
Maybe it was just time sharing done in a different way. You know, I just thought, geez. Look. So I got very disillusioned, and so I thought, I just didn't want to do that, so I decided to go to clown college once I got in, and I am a devastatingly bad physical comedian. I have no skills in that way at all.
That's
and there
they
I was in clown
there?
College. Yes. Well, that's what I learned, actually. Yeah. I learned that no matter how many things we did, I would get the laugh verbally. That my bits, when I described them, I could sell them like crazy. When it came time to doing them, it just wasn't there.
Is that what they call a kind of physical comedian? I mean, you
A clown is a definition of a physical comedian. It's something that we conceal very well in our show. Everybody will spend a lot of time saying, Teller doesn't talk. People don't usually spend a lot of time saying, Penn doesn't move. As far as I'm concerned in the show, I'm doing radio. But Teller has this whole other thing going on. But yeah, in clown college, I was already a very, very good juggler when I got to clown college. And I was very interested in, it's a very intensive program. And it was wonderful to go through anything that was difficult. After high school, I think that that's, you know, if I had to give advice to anybody that had gone through high school and been unhappy with it, I would just say, just do something hard. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter whether, you know, it's hard physically or hard mentally. But just for once, don't be hanging in there at above average and gliding through. So it was very, very difficult for me, and that was good.
And they were demanding of you? I mean, it was...
Oh, very, in every way. I mean, it was just in terms of hours per day and physically. You know, I'm certainly, you're not sitting here across from Sylvester Stallone. So to have me doing, you know, double backflips on a trampoline, you know, hurling 220 pounds of meat through the air, and doing push-ups and stuff. I mean, I'm talking about just difficult things. You know, because, of course, I wasn't the kind of person that would go into the service, so that was a good thing.
So did you leave or did you graduate or?
Well, they actually wanted me to go with the circus.
They did,
and mostly because of my juggling skills, and I just thought that would be a very, very bad idea. So I actually left clown college and began working with Teller. So I have no life. You've got high school. You've got like 6 weeks of clown college, and then you've got working with Teller for the rest of my life.
Well, you started when you were 19, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Working with Teller?
Yeah. Yeah. A little before that. I was actually 18 when we first started getting ideas.
Were your parents kind of practical jokers? I mean, were they people you could have fun with?
My parents are older. My mom and dad are both about 80. And they have a sister that's 23 years older than me. I mean, we're the only two kids. So I guess
23 years in between you.
They plan their children 23 years apart is one way to look at it.
So you've got two single children there, right?
Yes. And my mom, by the time I was 15, was already into the old lady thing and would use that every way she possibly could.
I mean, like, get me something? To be waited
on?
No,
much more like I remember when we would walk places, if it said, like, you know, don't walk across the grass, she would just, you know, walk across with me and said, you know, let them shoot an old lady and a hippie and see what kind of press they get. No, my mom was wonderful, just no respect for life or other people's property. It's something she passed on to this generation.
And was your dad a kind of a good foil for her, kind of a straight man?
Yeah, my mom was more of a mean, practical joker. And my dad was kind of a verbal jokester. So it was a good combination.
Well, you can see both of you.
Yeah.
Both of them in you.
Yeah, my mom was more quiet, and would then just hit you in the head with a broom. But Dad would tell jokes from the Carson monologue the next day, which I never forgave him for, because you heard the joke the night before. Why are you
Well, that's part of a sort of American ritual, don't you think?
I guess it is, yeah.
And all that. Have you ever been on Johnny Carson?
No,
Do they want you?
Yeah, they've asked us a couple times. There's a whole style of that that seems to me... there's a lot of things that bother me about that. I don't like that Johnny Carson makes and has made, like, marijuana jokes about the band. For some reason... I've never had a drink in my life and never any drugs. And I'm very, very anti-drug. And for some reason, you expect that kind of stuff out of Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
When it starts coming right into middle America, and I remember my parents watching Carson do a joke about the band smoking dope. And I'm not blaming him for this. He probably only done it three times in his career, but it was when I was 17. And I was strongly going up against everybody else in my high school taking acid, and my parents being complete teetotalers, and that being very important to me, and wanting to have long hair and listen to Hendrix in incredible volumes and still not do any drugs at all. And then he was there like it was the right thing to do, like it was the Playboy philosophy. And that always kind of troubled me. And yeah. I'm sure that we'll end up on the show. He's a wonderful performer and very, very funny, and certainly an institution, you know, certainly greater than the presidency. But I still had that weirdness. And Letterman I'm very comfortable with, because Letterman's a little bit closer to my generation.
And Letterman, I guess people are still talking about the cockroaches that you dumped on his...
It was really... the funniest comment on that was when we got the idea to dump 500 cockroaches on Letterman, I called my mom, you know. And my mom is not very showbiz savvy. She doesn't talk in showbiz slang. You know, she's from a small town in New England. And I said, you know, we're going to drop these cockroaches on Letterman. And she said, you will never work in show business again. she was just convinced. And Dave is such a remarkable man. I mean, Dave Letterman, I have such a high opinion of. He's just a complete workaholic. He works all the time, and I always respect that. And all that matters to him is that show.
Hmm.
So the fact those cockroaches fell on him, he had no idea they were coming. He had tears streaming down his cheeks and was trembling. Did not stop him from saying it was one of the best spots on the show and of being completely supportive of us.
We'll hear more from Penn Jillette, but first we'll take this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Let me introduce you again. My guest this afternoon is Penn Jillette. Do you miss the street? Do you miss street performing? I know you did some of that in Philadelphia.
Yeah, we did. We did a lot of it. It was always. I loved doing it. The reason I sound like this.
I mean, like your voice.
Yeah. The reason I sound like this is because when I worked out on the streets, I thought it was important to work for 300 people at a time and without a microphone.
Do you have nodes?
And, oh, I'm just speaking through scar tissue.
Is that right?
Yeah. I always think it's so funny when someone says I have a sexy voice. I always think it's like going up to someone that has an arm broken in five places and go, what an arm. But it's because of screaming. I mean, this is the voice of maybe a 50-year-old three-pack-a-day smoker.
I was going to say, smoking, yeah.
And it's on a non-smoker. It's just on someone that screamed. And I liked doing it very, very much.
How do you pick people out of the audience? And we were talking in the radio station here. It seems as if you have a fondness for women in leather skirts. Is that true?
I do have a fondness for women in leather skirts.
A lot of men I know do, but yes.
It just works. But I think that's a distortion. What I'm looking for, boy, we're going to come back to the same theme.
See?
Someone who's not drunk, someone who's not stoned, someone that doesn't want to be picked.
The people that kind of put their head down, are you likely to move in?
Not if they're theatrically not wanting to get picked. Someone that's pretty much looks like they're enjoying the show, but is pretty much not trying to call attention to themselves. You want someone that doesn't have something to say themselves, because that means that the chances that what they want to express is going to go nicely in the bit. Very, very slim. So we don't want, if they have a hidden agenda that's going to go on, then I have to accommodate that, and it's going to hurt some of the nicer things. So someone that's clear-eyed, I do try to pick, I mean, the leather skirt thing is obviously a joke, but I do try to pick on the men and women someone that I feel friendly towards, which is probably...
Because you're not always friendly to them.
Well, that's not true. I am loud, and I am aggressive, and I am fast. I am never insulting. Huge difference between those two. Journalists don't seem to pick it up. People, when they're speaking about it, don't pick it up. But I believe everyone feels it. If I get you up on stage, I'm not going to ever talk about your name. I'm not going to ever flirt with you. I'm not going to talk about where you're from. I'm not going to talk about how you're dressed. I'm not going to talk about your age or your education or what your beliefs are. If I stay away from those things, you'd be amazed at how loud I can yell in your face without it bothering you.
Yeah.
And people pick up on that very quickly, that I will yell at you about the show. You know, do you want to pick this or do you want to pick that? Or do you think you had a free choice? Do you want to do this? You want to throw the dart? Would you move over here? Move faster? Move over there? But you can come up there and say your name is anything, and you will not see a change in my face. You can come up there with a blue mohawk or a leather miniskirt or dressed in coveralls, and no one in that audience will be able to find anything in the way Teller and I carry ourselves that reacts to that at all. Because, I mean, boy, do I feel strongly about this. You have a right to call yourself by any name, wear your hair any way you want, and dress any way you want, and go anywhere you want. And if I'm going to have someone on stage with, like, a blue mohawk and make a joke about that, like other people in the audience don't know it and the person I'm talking to doesn't, or there's a woman up on stage that's dressed in a very sexy way, I'm the one that has to comment on that.
Mm.
I'm the one that has to say, you know, what's your name? Ruth. May I call you Ruth? What time? I mean, people really want to see me flirting with a random woman on stage. That's what they go to the theater for. I don't think so.
Okay.
So the fact is that I can get away with being incredibly loud, fast, and aggressive as long as I, as Teller says, keep that New England sensibility. He says, no matter how mean you try to get, you were still brought up in New England and it just flows out of you, you know? There's just things that I just couldn't comment on. I just spit on you, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Let me introduce you again. And my guest this afternoon is Penn Jillette.
And you do no advertising on this station, is that right?
We're just straight up. That's right. Well.
Well, a little bit.
How much are you willing to give away what the tricks are? And I know
it depends entirely on what you got on you. If it's money or stocks or something, it's the information
age.
You
passed me that money earlier.
I have it. It's just, you know, make me an offer.
Well, for instance,
okay.
when Teller swallows what looks like he swallows the pins. Now, I don't know whether...
It's actually needles.
Needles. He
swallows 100 needles, 100. 6 feet of thread.
And then pulls them out thread. And they're all threaded on uh-huh. They're all, the needles are all hanging on the thread there. Can you tell us what that's all about?
I could tell you how it's done. It would be technical and uninteresting. The stuff that I feel strongly about that is the fact that it is a trick.
Yeah.
If anybody thinks it isn't a trick, that he's somehow threading the needles in their stomach, they shouldn't think that because they shouldn't try it. But I think that we're coming to the point where to lay that out to you would be long-winded. And also uninteresting. It would be a little bit more like looking at a musical score. If you were going to perform
kind of analyzing
it
each...
and going over it carefully, you would see some of the beauty in it. Mm-hmm. To give you just enough to be smug, I don't think there's an upside to.
Okay.
But it's a neat trick.
It's a great
and if
trick.
You for someone that was in the business of doing these kind of things, it might be nice to analyze it. But otherwise, I don't think. Oh, I have another way to say this.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Well, then, why do you wear gray suits? And you know, they look like suits that you'd wear to your first job interview.
I mean, yeah. Well, exactly.
With the red ties. And
we wear the gray suits. There's a couple answers to that. I used to dress like in a leather jacket. You know, I used to dress like the way I'm dressed now.
Right.
Just jeans and engineer boots. You know, and I found that it gave part of the audience something to hold on to. The people who dressed like me then thought I was one of them. The people that didn't thought I was one of them. They had something to hold on to and feel good about. Whereas a gray suit is pretty near invisible.
Mm.
Everybody you've seen in that kind of dress. It's the closest you can have to just completely
blandness.
Bland.
Yeah.
And that puts, which the whole show is designed to, puts the attention on us. Not on props, not on big mirrors, not on dancing girls, but on us, and the gray suits do that too. The interesting thing is that Robert Houdin, who Houdini took his name from, was the first magician to work in tails,
yeah.
The standard magician outfit, the greasy guy in the tux. And the reason he did that, it was a breakthrough. Every magician before that would always be a phony Asian act, you know, Chung Ling Su with the big flowing robes or the conical hat. And his huge breakthrough in magic was to dress exactly like the audience. It was unbelievably radical at the time. It was a totally fresh idea. People went to the theater in tails and gloves and top hat, and he came on stage that way and turned the whole thing inside out and ripped them to pieces. It was a wild, wild thing to do. And then everybody who came after him forgot the reason and just said, oh, there's real neat places to hide doves in these pockets. We'll keep going. So consequently, you get to the 40s and 50s, and the guys are still dressing like that 100 years later, and they haven't noticed the audience has changed. So in a certain way, it's coming back to that kind of idea. The attention really should be on what we're saying and doing and the ideas of the show, and not on why are they dressed like that.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because I think in part that's true, but in part I said to myself, why are they dressed like that?
I always liked the monkeys. You know, the monkeys are an uncredited influence. I always liked the way the monkeys always dressed in matching suits that were a little different. Like one would have like a red turtleneck, one had like a red t-shirt. So I wear a three-piece suit and Teller wears a two-piece suit.
Yes, yeah, I did notice
the difference. And I wear cowboy boots, so we're dressed almost alike. And I've always liked that. Yeah, the thing is that I think that you would kind of say, why are they dressed like that? Mm-hmm. And someone who would be very comfortable with the suits would say, why does he have his hair cut like that?
Yeah, exactly.
And or why does he have the boots like that? Or why is his nail painted? Or why all those bracelets? And it's very, very important that no one feel more comfortable in our show than other people. I mean, your theater patrons, you know, what I always say is we like to get people with blue hair for all different reasons. But, you know, your older theater patrons should be, say, what the hell's going on here? And your punks should say the same thing. Everybody should feel a little off balance so that then we can take them from there and do what we want to do.
Are you ever afraid of the kind of clones of Penn and Teller that someone's going to take, you know, the sort of McDonaldizing of what you're doing?
You're welcome to it. I've been told.
Not me.
I've been told that at magic conventions, little psycho Penn and Tellers are starting to pop
right?
up, where they just get up on stage, two kids like 16 scream violently and then spurt blood in some way. They just tried to hold on to that. I don't know. I don't have no idea. I'd be the last one to know, because
would you be insulted?
I don't know if I'd recognize one.
Ugh.
You know, when you describe bits in the show, if you were to describe it in detail, what you would be describing is probably very different from what I think the major thrusts are. So I don't know if you were to see a Penn and Teller clone, what you were seeing might be, you know, you might find Simon and Garfunkel to be a Penn and Teller clone because of the height differences. You know, there might be something like that, but I don't know what I would perceive that way. I'm probably too close to it.
Penn Jillette is half of the magic duo Penn and Teller. They have a movie coming out called Penn and Teller Get Killed. They also have a home video and a book, both called Penn and Teller's Cruel Tricks for Dear Friends. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Terry Gross hosts a live concert with jazz pianist Dave McKenna. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. I'm filling in while Terry Gross attends the annual public radio conference. There's no telling how many people Elmore Leonard has robbed, mugged, shot, or blown up. Coming up, we talk with the author of the best-selling crime novels Glitz, Freaky Deaky, and Killshot. Also, Harry Connick Jr. joins us again in our weekly performance spot, and critic Ken Tucker reviews the home video version of Run DMC's movie. It's called Tougher Than Leather, and it's not a gentle romance. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. A crackdown has begun in Beijing, with the Chinese government ordering troops into the capital to put down more than a month of student-led demonstrations for increased democratic rights. In an address provided to NPR by the cable news network, Chinese Premier Li Peng announced what amounts to a state of martial law in Beijing.
The boycott of the class and the hunger strike has already destroyed the stability of the society.
But while the large-scale protests were started by students, in the last few days, Chinese from all walks of life joined in. At one point, millions of people were occupying Beijing's central Tiananmen Square. And with such widespread public support, the BBC's James Miles reports that some troops are having trouble getting at the protesters.
There has been some opposition to the intervention of the army in this dispute. And we hear, in fact, that all of the three columns of army trucks that have so far been seen moving into the city have been surrounded by hundreds of people, not just demonstrators, it appears, but also people, ordinary residents, who are involved in trying to stop the army from taking any action against the students. They've been swarming over the vehicles. They've been taunting the soldiers, saying that as the people's army, they should not take action against the people.
James Miles in Beijing. Today's decision to use the military against the protesters may have also caused a schism in China's leadership. There were reports that Communist Party chief Zhao Xiang had either resigned or been forced from office. Zhao has expressed sympathy for the student-led protests. In Washington, the U.S. government has appealed to Chinese authorities to avoid bloodshed in handling the protests. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
In a statement released late today, the Bush administration said the U.S. supports freedom of speech, association, and peaceful assembly, and then added, "We regret that military action has been ordered with the aim of restricting those freedoms." An administration official said this afternoon, the U.S. embassy has conveyed to Chinese authorities, quote, "the strong hope that violence and bloodshed will be avoided." The State Department has taken note of the fact that Chinese authorities have promised a dialogue with the students. We hope that dialogue will be pursued, the State Department said. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
President Bush brought his top military advisors up to his summer home in Kennebunkport, Maine today to review plans for the upcoming NATO summit. Scott Hood of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network reports.
The president met this morning with Defense Secretary Richard Cheney, National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, and Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral William Crow. Following the session, White House spokesperson Marlon Fitzwater said the group discussed short-range nuclear forces but did not reach any final decisions. The Bush administration wants to upgrade NATO's nuclear weapons, while West Germany wants the U.S. and Soviet Union to discuss reductions in the nuclear arsenal in Europe. The disagreement threatens to disrupt the NATO summit later this month in Brussels. President Bush will be looking for support for his position tomorrow when he welcomes French President François Mitterrand to his seaside home in Kennebunkport. Fitzwater says the French president appears to be in agreement with Bush on the strength of NATO. For National Public Radio, this is Scott Hood with the president in Kennebunkport, Maine.
A senior official in the West German capital of Bonn reported that following a meeting between Secretary of State James Baker and West Germany's defense minister today, the U.S. and West Germany agreed to on a various plan to unravel the missile problems. They agreed to support negotiations on short-range missiles in Europe if West Germany promises not to push for total elimination of those meetings at the NATO meeting. It was a big day on Wall Street as the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 30.98, surging past the 2,500 mark for the first time since the stock market crash in 1987. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Pianist and singer Harry Connick Jr. is with us again for our weekly performance spot. Connick grew up in New Orleans and first performed there when he was in elementary school. But now, at the age of 21, he's gained a national reputation for his playing, a mix of blues, stride piano, and jazz. Today, he's got two songs for us.
People often ask me who my favorite composer is, and pretty much without hesitation, I'll say Harold Arlen, because he was just such a great composer, and he wasn't recognized for all the hits that he had. In fact, he was riding in a cab in New York, and the cab driver was whistling Stormy Weather, one of Harold Arlen's compositions. And Harold Arlen said, "Do you know who wrote that song?" And the cabbie said, he says, "No, I don't." And Harold Arlen said, "Well, I wrote it." And the cab driver said, "Who are you?" And Harold said, I'm Harold Arlen." And the cab driver said, "Who?" It just goes to show you that he wasn't the most popular of composers by name recognition, but he really wrote some tunes that everyone knows and loves. And here's one of his biggest hits of all time. I've Got the World on a String.
Life is a wonderful thing if you've got the world on a string. I'd be a silly so-and-so if I should ever let you go. I've got the world on a string, sitting on a rainbow. Got the string around my finger. Oh, golly gee, I'm in love.
Harold Arlen. Boy, what a tune that is. He wrote a million other tunes just as great. And right now I'd like to do another one of my favorites with a little bit of Louis Armstrong influence. As he once said, "What's the matter with you, boy? Don't you know I got a right to sing the blues?" I've got a right to sing the blues. I've got a right to moan and sigh, right to sit and cry down around the river. A certain gal in this old town
She just keeps dragging my heart around. All I see for me is misery. I've got a right to sing the blues, right to feel low down. I've got a right to hang around, down around the river. When the deep blue sea, it just keeps calling me. Yes, it must be love. Say what you choose, I've got a right to sing the blues. It must be love, say what you choose. I've got a right to sing the blues.
Harry Connick Jr.'s recordings are on the CBS record label. Here's an original composition called E. This is Fresh Air. Leonard's latest book is called Kill Shot, and like his previous books, there's danger, violence, and guns. Leonard has written more than 24 crime novels, among them the bestsellers Freaky Deaky, Glitz, and Bandits. Elmer Leonard started writing pulp westerns in the 50s. He also spent some time writing scripts for Encyclopedia Britannica films, as well as screenplays in Hollywood. Leonard's crime novels are praised for their accuracy and their believability. When I asked Elmer Leonard how he knew so much about guns and bombs, he told me he's got some friends.
There's a police officer in the Detroit Police Department who's firearms and explosives expert. He taught me for Freaky Deaky how to blow up a car. I went to him for Freaky Deaky and said, "How do you make a bomb?" And he handed me a copy of the Anarchist Cookbook, which was published about 20 years ago.
But you don't feel like you have to handle this stuff yourself to be able to write about it. You can rely on someone else's description for you.
Oh, yeah. I don't think you have to have experienced much of anything, really, to be a writer. No.
When writing about criminals, mm-hmm. if they were just purely evil, would they be good characters?
They wouldn't be interesting to me, no, because I don't think of them solely when they're committing crimes. I think maybe that's the distinction, that I think of them off stage. I think of them when they get up in the morning, when they're thinking about what they're going to wear, what they're going to have for breakfast, as we all do. I think of my bad guy sneezing at a moment when he's completely helpless, you know, and I think of him when he's a child. I think of my antagonists being childish, or having never really grown up, matured. I think of most often my good guy as being more childlike, more open and honest, direct.
Do you feel like you know the criminal mind, whatever that is?
I don't think there is such a thing. I think you apply, if you decide to be a criminal or to commit crimes, you apply the same knowledge or the same capacity that you have to do good. I don't know what that means, a criminal mind.
I guess people mean a kind of psychopathic mind where...
Yeah, well, if sociopathic or psychopathic, that's something else. But I never get into the background of why does this individual behave the way he does. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in what he does, well, how he does behave on the surface and how it affects the other characters in the book. And that's my purpose in writing, in fact, is to just to get this interaction among the characters, how they talk to one another, what they do to one another. The plot comes along. The plot is a bag of money, or it really doesn't matter to me what it is. It comes along.
What has sustained you in writing crime kinds of novels?
I think that within the framework of the crime story, I can do anything I want. There are scenes of what we would call from mainstream fiction, mainstream kind of scenes in my books, a husband and wife situation. But at the same time, there's the gun waiting to go off. And I think it's a lack of confidence in my writing. I don't know. That I need that gun waiting to go off. And whether it does or not, I'm not always sure. I'm writing a book right now that's set in Hollywood, and no one has been shot yet. I'm 150 pages into it. And I'm not sure that anyone will be shot.
Are you in part waiting for one of the characters to pick up the gun?
I think as a reader I am, certainly, sure. Yeah, and I have described the fact that one of the characters, and maybe the least likely one, does own a gun and does wave his gun in the office. And will it ever go off? I don't know, because I'm never sure what's going to happen in my books. I'm from day to day, I'm anxious to see what's going to happen.
You talk about calling up friends of yours that know about guns and about making bombs, and I know that you do spend time, or have spent time, in police departments, listening to the ways the cops talk to each other and talk over the phone. And there was a quote I read that you said that most detectives are funny guys with this dry, deadpan approach.
I found it that they are funny. They have the nice, deadpan, straight-faced type of humor that I like. Particularly, and that the cops around the country in the different places where I have researched all have pretty much the same attitude. Different accents, but the same attitude. And all have been very, very cooperative, giving me whatever I want.
And they let you sit and listen? Is that what you do when you spend time?
Yeah. It was about 10 years ago that I did a piece for the Detroit News for the Sunday magazine in which they said, do a piece on the homicide section, whatever you want, from whatever aspect you want. So I spent 3 weeks with them before I even wrote a word. And it was the kind of thing that a journalist would spend 3 or 4 days and take 2 days to write, and that's it. But I saw all this material, and I was listening to all this good dialogue. So it was 3 weeks before I wrote a word. A detective would walk in and say, "What's he doing here?" And he said, "Be quiet." He said, "Don't bother him. He's listening." And we got along fine. And then I wrote it. It was called Impressions of Murder. A lot of dialogue in it. I showed it to the cops before I submitted it to the paper, even. And they loved it because I respected them. I liked what they were doing. I liked them personally. I didn't do this so much in other cities because I had specific information that I needed about procedures. Or, for example, in the case of La Brava, I would talk to a detective as I was beginning the book, find out the procedures and so on. And now I've got an extortion scheme going in the book. And at that point, I go back to Miami Beach and talk to the detective. I said, "Okay, you get this extortion note, a demand for $650,000. What would you do?" Or I'm in Atlantic City. You find a woman on the sidewalk here at 1:30 in the morning. She's obviously fallen from a great height. What would you do? What's the first thing you would do? And the detective says, "I would look up and see if there's a window open or something."
You say about your style, or you say, "My sound is the absence of me." And you say you write with a style that has no style. Others have called it a kind of self-effacing writing style. Do you try to get out of the way of your story?
Oh, absolutely.
And how do you do that?
I mean, I don't want you ever to be aware of me. I don't want to ever use words that my characters wouldn't use. It's all of the scenes, all of the narrative, from dialogue into narrative, is always from a point of view, so that the narrative takes on the sound of whosever point of view that is, whatever character's point of view that is. And as long as you're aware of that character, you can't be aware of me.
We were talking before we actually went on the air about how long you've been writing, and you said that the idea that you've been a struggling writer for many years is really a wrong one, but you are now a very successful writer. What do you think that success means to you? Is that something that you wear easily?
I think so. If it had happened earlier, I think it might have become a problem, yeah. But now, I know what I do, and I know that I have to sit down at my desk every day and do it. And this is where the satisfaction is. The pleasure is in doing it and in having done it, but not in any notoriety attached to it. There's great satisfaction in someone coming up to you at a bookstore and signing and saying, God, I love your book. I love the way you write. That's wonderful. But writing it, that's the satisfaction.
Yeah, and there's no one in the room there when you're writing.
No one there. And it's hard to believe sometimes. When I'm sitting there alone, I think, my God, I can write anything I want. I can write, I can please myself, and they'll give me a lot of money for it.
Elmore Leonard's latest novel, Kill Shot, is published by Arbor House. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Co-host Noah Adams has joined us. Noah, what's the word on China?
What amounts to martial law has been imposed in the city of Beijing. Demonstrations have been banned and troops are moving into the city. Also this evening, we'll talk with a senior vice president of the Exxon Corporation about the cleanup efforts in Alaska. And should that oil spill be referred to as Exxon's oil spill or the Alaska oil spill? And we'll talk with musician Bunny Wailer about his new album called Liberation. He's a reggae player and singer from Jamaica, a founding member, a surviving member, in fact, of the Wailers.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more are coming up from All Things Considered on National Public Radio. The movie Tougher Than Leather, starring the rap group Run-DMC, opened in theaters last year, played for a few weeks, and then disappeared. Now it's out on home video. Rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
When I heard that Tougher Than Leather was coming out on video cassette, I couldn't wait to see it. Even though it got bad reviews, I had my radar out. I figured this had to be an overlooked gem. Why? Well, first of all, because film critics don't know much, if anything, about rap music. I thought that my discerning ear in this area would enable me to see past the amateurism of a first movie to what I hoped was a revitalization of the black action picture in the grand tradition of Superfly and Trouble Man. The idea behind Tougher Than Leather was a great one. It was intended to be a rap gangster movie, an urban shoot-em-up shot in the style of a Sergio Leone spaghetti western. As befits the rough, often serious music they make, the three members of Run-DMC are hard-boiled heroes, a welcome change from the way pop music idols usually portray themselves on screen. Rock stars like to make themselves look good or even goody-goody in movies, whether we're talking about Elvis Presley or the Beatles or Sting. But in this movie, Run-DMC are playing gun-toting pop stars out to get back the money they're owed by a crooked concert promoter. This is the ultimate rock star revenge story in a way, but unfortunately too many of the scenes end up like this one, in which Run-DMC break into the room of a hood played by Richard Edson.
Who is it?
Bellboy, I got fresh linens.
Yo, who killed Ray?
I don't know.
Who killed Ray?
I don't know.
Russell.
No! Oh, God. Oh.
You gonna talk? Who killed him?
I'll talk.
Speak!
Vic killed him, man. Vic killed Runny Ray.
Why?
Jerry was still looking for Vic, man. Vic busted Jerry, man. Runny Ray came in on it, man. It was this thing of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. I tried to stop him, but I couldn't.
Sure you did.
I did, I swear to God. It happened too fast.
Who else was there?
Arthur. Nathan.
Come on, man. You're gonna take us to Vic. Get up.
There's a lot of that sort of thing. Tougher Than Leather was directed by Run-DMC's real-life record producer, Rick Rubin. He's a terrific producer, but as a director, he's got an awful lot to learn about how to tell a story. The movie also features amusing cameos by rap acts such as Slick Rick and the Beastie Boys. Just recently, one of the Beasties, Adam Horowitz, got some good reviews in a film that's opened theatrically, Lost Angels, but you'd never know he could act from the horsing around he does in this movie. Tougher Than Leather is interesting. Interesting enough to rent, I'd say. It's just not the groundbreaking rap movie I was hoping for. That one has yet to be made. Other new videocassette releases include Things Change, written and directed by playwright David Mamet. It stars Don Ameche as an elderly Sicilian shoe repairman. He's offered a lot of money to take the rap for a murder committed by an organized crime figure. He's placed under the care of a small-time hood, played by Joe Mantegna, who has to guard the old man until his trial. They go off on a lark of a weekend, and that's where Mamet's combination of tough but lyrical dialogue gives the heavy-handed plot its light touch.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, Terry Gross will talk with cultural historian Michael Barson. He's collected some of the best, or the worst, B-movie posters into a book called Lost, Lonely, and Vicious. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new album from pianist Cecil Taylor. So hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Ed Dougherty, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Laura Civitz. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.